you took a public opinion poll about polls, odds are that a majority would offer some rather unfavorable view of pollsters, like me, and how our work is used. Words like manipulation, slicing and dicing, and triangulation are regularly used to describe the vice that is public opinion research. Yet if you asked whether politicians, business leaders, and journalists should pay attention to the people's voices, almost everyone would say yes. And if you then asked whether polls are at least one tool through which the desires and aspirations of the people can be determined, a reluctant majority would probably say yes to that too. This is the conflicted reputation of polling and public opinion. Welcome to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm your host, David Coletto from Abacus Data. This week, we explore the concept of public opinion itself by inviting one of Canada's leading pollsters, Frank Graves. Frank is the founder and president of Ecos Research Associates. He's been studying Canadian public opinion for over 40 years, working with governments, nonprofits, and unions to understand the dynamics of Canadian public opinion. I sat down with Frank at the end of 2020, just before the holidays, to discuss his approach to public opinion research and what his experience over the past 40 years has taught him about what Canadians think and why they think what they do. Please enjoy our discussion. I am so pleased to be joined by Frank Graves. He's the founder, CEO of Ecos Research Associates. Frank, you are the first pollster that I'm interviewing as part of this series, and I thought, you know, no one could bring the kinds of insights that you can. So welcome. Thanks for doing this.
I'm really, really pleased to be here with today, Dave. Really looking forward to this.
So I'm starting every conversation with a question, particularly those in the field who study public opinion as a profession, about what your overall, if you have one, philosophy or starting point is when it comes to public, to studying public opinion. You know, how do you view at its core what causes us to think what we do, you know, what impact it has on our behavior? Do you have a framework by which you analyze?
Yeah, I don't have anything that, you know, organized, but I have some broad views about public opinion, or what I like to more generally think of as applied social research, which we don't use that label anymore. We prefer the dark arts of polling, but I really think of it as assembling empirical evidence in support of better decision-making, better policy, just better understanding of how societies and political systems work. So my driving interests are, to what extent can polling reveal things that are important for us, either just to satisfy our intellectual curiosity or to, more importantly, help out with making better decisions, better policies. And, you know, I think that I'm extremely positive about the role that sound public opinion can play in shaping a better understanding of how societies, democracies, economies work, but also in terms of making better decision-making, which reflects the public interest. And, the whole range of influences I've had. I mean, I'm trained as initially a social anthropologist and then a sociologist with a lot of focus on both small M and large M methodology. By small M, I mean the raft of all the statistics and theories of probability, which I found very difficult but helpful, but also large M methodology, just the questions of epistemology, philosophy of science. How do you draw conclusions about what really caused what? And so putting those tools together to look at, you know, critical problems of the day, like we're working, I'm working almost daily, as I know you are, on trying to better understand the pandemic and public response and human behavior and which way it's going to go. And it's been, you know, incredibly interesting, and I've never seen such massive movements in public opinion and behavior. Because, you know, I'm not just interested in public opinion. I mean, if we look at a range of things, and I know you want to talk about this later, but from you know, the ephemera of public opinion, which can shift fairly rapidly and mercurially to more stable attitudes and beliefs. But I'm also interested in behavior. I'm interested in knowledge and understanding what public literacy exists on each day. And at the top, I guess, of this pyramid, we have those more primordial things we call values, mm-hmm. these more ultimate statements of what's right and wrong and how, what kind of society we want to live in. So all of those things together can be extremely powerful tools.
And just to, before, we'll come back to COVID at the end, but you mentioned it, and I know in we connected earlier, and you were talking about how in a way amazed you were at the shift in people's, for example, attitudes and then behaviors towards wearing a mask in a very short period of time.
It's become, I've never seen such massive, and I'm not using hyperbole, movements of human populations in terms of behavior, beliefs, anxieties. This has just been a once in a lifetime collision of historical risks on both health and economic nature. But yeah, and I also remember it was interesting because, you know, at the outset of this, we started doing our longitudinal work really the first week that the pandemic was kind of at least taking off in Canada in early March. And I remember at the time, I've worked with and I admire a lot of the public health epidemiologists, immunologists, virologists, they're all really, really smart, interesting people. But I really thought that their understanding of human behavior and how to respond with agility and effectiveness, it's just not what they do. You know, they're used to, like, I'm sitting on a task force now on vaccine hesitancy, and these people are brilliant, and they come from, like, the top experts from WHO and so forth. But they've been looking at these problems for decades, and how do we move the needle on having higher acceptance amongst families so that they'll get their children to take HPV vaccine or whatever. And I'm going, like, that's got not a whole lot to do with this thing has a level of salience and literally life and death stakes associated with it that people are going to respond, I think, differently. I know at the beginning I was told, oh, you know, masks are not a good idea, either they're not effective. And like, I'm not an immunologist or an epidemiologist. Although interesting, the tools of epidemiology are not that different from the tools we were versed in. But the idea that if someone wore their mask, forget about whether they were effective or not, turns out there was asymptomatic transmission. But the idea that if you put on a mask, you suddenly would behave in a riskier fashion. And I said, well, where is that coming from? It comes from something called risk homeostasis or risk compensation theory, which was a discredited study done about 60 years ago that posited that people wearing seatbelts when they became mandatory would drive faster and therefore you would offsetting risk. First of all, the study itself was debunked. And second of all, but what do you think that has to do with this particular situation? 50 years ago in another country. So I said, look, let me just go out and test this. So we tested, you know, the relationship between wearing a mask. And by the way, wearing a mask has gone from 5% in March to 95%.
Right.
Think about another area of human behavior that we've tried to influence, from seatbelt to drunk driving. You name it. It took decades, and this transformation occurred in months. But what I found was that not only did people who wore masks not behave riskier and less prudently, it was the opposite. There was a virtuous circle. Not because they put a mask on didn't make them maintain social distance and not touch their face. The core driver was risk. If you felt a certain level of risk, then you'd be more likely to put a mask, which means you also would avoid risky situations. You'd wash your hands more frequently. But we really ended up on a bit of a wrong track on some of these things. And that's an area where I think, you know, the behavioral sciences can definitely contribute in ways. I feel that a lot of this is almost like a political campaign. We need to, you know, figure out what messages work. Where are the hot zones? How do we get in there really fast? And that's just not what a lot of public health seems to be doing.
And that's where I think, you know, your work, our work, and those in sort of the public affairs world understand, you know, the nimbleness needed to communicate and take data and make decisions that are driving those kinds of campaigns. I wanna dig a little deeper, maybe at the start of things. And one of the the topics we're grappling in my class early on in the course, but I think comes up all the time in the work that we do, particularly in the public affairs space. And that is, you know, we know in our work every day that Canadians on many issues don't have firm opinions about certain things, right? Like, I always use the example of like aquaculture, right? I've done some work for the sector. We ask about it, but do most people actually have, you know, any real sense of the sector and any opinions about it? So that this idea that not everybody maybe has opinions about everything has led some to argue that even the concept of public opinion can't exist in that kind of environment. Mm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, public opinion, and again, we've talked about a continuum of different aspects of public opinion. It can be scientifically measured with reliability and validity, which can be demonstrated. It's intersubjective and repeatable. You can show that the concepts that you're measuring are epistemically correlated with the theoretical variables you're trying. Does that mean that everybody has views on everything and that every piece of the public opinion has to be collected? Of course not. But I mean, there's very few issues that I don't think have an interesting public opinion angle on them, but there's many that are far more important than others. And, you know, I'm not going to pretend that we should be paying equal attention and effort to all those. I think we tend to focus on the things which have the most impact on people's lives, which are ones where bad decisions can have the worst consequences, or where we're just frankly, you know, pandering to the insatiable curiosity about who's going to win the next election. If the idea that it's not measurable is just visibly wrong, it is. There's a massive literature, as you know, of experimental research, very sophisticated stuff. The science of public opinion is one of the more sophisticated fields in social science, in my opinion. So I like to think of it, though, as more, I'm more interested, and I borrow from, say, Daniel Yankovic's notion of coming to public judgment. You will find that there is a complex process where individuals will move from the initial, not very rooted, public opinion on a key issue, be it free trade or whether we should, you know, accelerate the rate of opening the economy in the COVID world. But they will, after they get a chance to sort through it on a reconciliation of values and information, you'll find that they increasingly come to a point where they are making a public judgment. And generally, I believe the public can be quite wise, although some of my recent research suggests there are systematic groups that aren't. But I'm more of the James Surowiecki, the wisdom of crowds, than the side which says it's all foolish. But the issue of disinformation is something which goes along with my interest, and I know you share the interest in populism, particularly authoritarian populism. But you know, it's just remarkable what kind of changes. We talked about some of the other behavioral changes, but you know, we have this incredible sorting and coordination of disbeliefs, not disbeliefs, disinformation, just you know, stuff which didn't exist at the beginning of, for example, COVID. I don't want to focus on that, but people who had views about masks had their views, and people who had views about vaccines had their. They weren't that tightly interdependent. Now they're really, really coherent. And we have to ask ourselves, why do we see the same people who think that, you know, the virus was manufactured in a lab, think that, you know, they're going to get sick if they put a mask on? I mean, they don't seem to be, you know, connected pieces of information. And I think they are. They're being curated now more so in the past by things like social media, in particular, certain parts of social media. Anyway,
those networks appear to be much, much stronger, right? At driving those correlated views together and creating these nodes of communities that are actually at once connected to each other, but then I think like isolated from each other. So they never even are talking or interacting. That's a relatively new phenomenon.
That's new. I mean, we always had, I mean, there was a body of research Eric Hoffer and others talked about true believers, and there's a sociology of knowledge. You look at people studying millennial cults, and they'd find it's remarkable. They would all think they're going up in the spacecraft on this day, and the day comes and nothing happens, and they all just reassemble their beliefs around another day.
Right.
But if you can imagine that capacity for true belief harnessed to, you know, social media, QAnon, you know, the 4chan, you know, what's on YouTube and so forth, it becomes much, much more powerful. And also, I think it's also rooted in some shifts that are going on. I had an interesting session with a fellow that runs what's called the Digital Hate Network in London on a call last week. And he looks at it much more from the side of all the organizers who are remarkably sophisticated and are weaving all these things together. But I look at it in terms of, you know, the individuals that are attracted to this, and they seem to correspond to a lot of the, you know, the authoritarian populist reflex that we've seen with Brexit and Trump, and I think it's operating here in Canada. And there are people who have been, frankly, left behind. The deal hasn't worked out very much for them. They're low information. They tend to have not the same levels of educational attainment as others, which is one of the reasons they've fallen behind. As the economy that used to get you middle class membership with a strong back and a union card, mm-hmm. no longer provides that security or opportunity. So you get angry. The values you believed in when you were growing up are no longer seen increasingly as anachronistic. Your security's gone. You feel so. It all becomes fertile for creating these really coherent and emotionally engaged groups that are, you know, just completely offside with pretty well everything that the, you know, the dominant sort of positions within the society, be an issue around COVID, but just narratives around things like climate change, belief mm-hmm. in science, you know, whether mainstream media is full of fake news. All of these views coalesce and I think produce something we haven't seen in the past.
The level of consistency is remarkable, and that's a shift that is recent. I want to get your views. You know, you've been, I think you're in your, ECOS is 40 years, right? Your 40th anniversary.
That was 10 when I started it.
And so that's an impressive kind of history of looking at Canada even, right? And studying how Canada's changed in the last 40 years. I think, you know, for our audience, having been at the center of measuring and looking at Canadians through their eyes, through the interviews you've done, qual, quant, how have, you know, or what are some of the areas where you've seen the biggest shifts in, we'll get to values in a minute, but on attitudes and opinions where that come up as, you know, very clear in your mind about where the country might have been 40 years ago and where we are today?
Yeah, I know, it's a great question. And I'll begin by telling you that as someone who has measured these things in a, you know, a semantically consistent fashion with high quality samples for many years, I can see these changes quite vividly. And you know, there's a few areas that I'm really, really interested in. But I'll also tell you that I continually hear from clients and experts and colleagues and friends, this was always stuff that was going on. You know, society was always polarized, or, you know, people always felt resentful towards those at the top. And I go, you know what? That's just not the case. So, you know, if I were to pick two or three key critical indicators, so we'll look at, let's pick out sort of trust in institutions, but trust in government in particular. When this started being tracked, and Gallup was one of the first to track it in the United States, in the 60s and 70s, the question, I think I can trust the government in Washington to do the right thing all or most of the time, 80% would agree. It was tracked in Canada as well. I wasn't around at that point, but I started, and others have tracked it. And interestingly, both Canada and the United States work in lockstep. We tend to have this narcissism of difference where we think we're nothing like the States. On most of the key indicators, including values, and I've published on this academically, there's not two countries in the world with more similar value systems, and they're converging, not diverging. So trust in government in both Canada and the United States was in the 80% range in the 60s and 70s, started declining around the time I started doing my work. I don't know if there was a causal relationship, but it just fell in a lockstep in a straight line in both Canada and the United States and went down to below 20% from 80%. Some have called this the decline of deference. This is post-materialism. Part of it's a good thing. You don't want everybody to be like the kind of compliant, docile populations that came right after the Second World War. But at a certain point, you know, it becomes really, really challenging in a society where nobody trusts anyone. Other major changes have gone on, and some of these are linked. In we measure social class. If you can measure it, I was on a conference with the OECD guru. He says, I have 142 different measures of social class. I said, I just have one. I ask people, are you a member of the middle class, the working class, the poor, or the upper class? And Pew does this as well. And it works really quite well. But the key point is that as this century opened up in Canada and the United States, once again, same numbers, about 65% of Canadians and Americans located themselves as members of the middle class. Closer to 70, actually. In both countries, that's gone down to the point where now in the United States, it's about 45%. In Canada, it's gone up a bit in the last few years, but still hovering around 50%. So in the States, 70 million people fell out of the middle class. They didn't go into the upper class, they went into the working class. And that sense of they're the same people. Like, these numbers look nothing like in the past. The whole middle class bargain.
If I could just interrupt, because you talked about, it's a question, you're asking people to self-identify what class they're in.
Yes.
And so tell me, why does it matter? And I'm asking this more for you to help enlighten us on and those listening, that the perception changes. That actually, you know, someone's income may not change, right? But the perception that, what does it mean that somebody identifies a member of the middle class versus not, in terms of everything else they think about the world?
Yeah, well, where you see yourself, and there's new research coming out on this as we speak, we sort of lost touch with the notion of social status. Socioeconomic status usually included not just income and education, but also identity and prestige. And increasingly now we're finding that a lot of these individuals, even though they might not look that different on the actual pocketbook issue than they did in the last election, in terms of issues of their sense of security and identification, sense as the breadwinner and the traditional family values that were associated, that's all been shattered. By the way, the actual economy has changed dramatically. If you look at the growth rates in Canada and the United States, again, very, very similar, in the period from the 30s through till the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, the average GDP growth in both countries ran about the same rate. It was close to 7-8%. Think about the compounding effect of 7-8%. In this century, the average GDP is probably around 1%. So not only that, the concentration of wealth in what was called the Great Leap Forward by the rates of distribution of growth, there's much more growth, and it's going pretty well. Poor people are going ahead, rich people are going ahead, everyone's going ahead. This sort of shared prosperity model means that everybody's moving ahead. That all started stopping in the 80s, basically, and it's reached the point now where in both Canada and the United States, depending which measure you get, the 5% of wealth that was secured in the upper 1% is now 15 to 20%, and it's been accelerating in the pandemic. So you have more tepid growth, most of it being appropriated by a very, very tiny fraction of people at the top. So it's just not working for most people. So yes, there is an aspirational component, but a lot of this is also backed up by, you know, the actual numbers. And the people think it hasn't happened yet. Just read Lars Osberg's last book, you'll see how dramatic these shifts are. And in some of the numbers in Canada are concealed by higher rates of private corporations being used. So yeah, there's definitely, but just one final point on the sort of the self-defined. Mm-hmm. If I do a non-parametric correlation between income and self-defined social class, it correlates about 0.7. So there definitely is a link to income. Here's an interesting one. If I correlate it to rated health, which is actually an excellent predictor of actual health, 0.8. If I correlate it with overall life happiness, 0.9. Social class is quality of life. And so if you've had real or imagined, and I think it's like a combination of both, more heavy on the real side, 60 million people falling out of the middle class, and it's not that those connections to well-being and to health and so forth, you got a real problem. And yeah. I believe that the polarization that we're seeing right now, people may go, oh, I'm so happy that the Americans got a new government. It's not going to solve this fundamental problem. It'll give you a bit of a time out and you can regroup. But unless you go back to the causes which produced this, which are only evident in terms of a longer term sort of macro sociological perspective, the chances of really dealing with this are pretty slim.
One of the, just building off the identity question here, like, so class identity is one way we can look at a population and how they connect themselves to the world. You know, I don't know, famously, Stephen Harper wrote his book and talked about the anywheres and the somewheres, right? Or the those who are on the inside, those on the out, like the elite versus the non-elite. Is that related or is that a different, you know?
No, that's definitely related. And he gets that, I forget the British author who I met, smart guy. And the idea is the anywheres are the global elites sitting in airline lounges, ready to go to Davos. It's a little contrived, but still, you know, they're basically the highly educated professional class. And the somewheres are the salt of the earth that have been, you know, left behind, stranded in their communities, which have seen their manufacturing or their coal mine stripped. And so there's this real resentment. And I think part of that is true, but I think that there's much more to the story than simply that. The, for example, people went back after Brexit trying to figure out, well, what explains this? And the thinking was, well, it's where you live. If you're in the downtown urban core of London, you're a leaver, you're a stayer. If you're in the burned out factory districts or where coal mines shut down, you're gonna be, you know, a leaver. And they put those into the logit model predicting how people voted with some exit polling and accounted for 5% of the variance, which is useful, but not impressive.
Right.
Put in another question that said, I think sex criminals should be whipped in prison. And they got 70% explanation. And that's a classic measure of authoritarian outlook. And the argument is that this reflex, which is occurs under certain conditions, the hyper-concentration of wealth being one of them, economic despair, cultural backlash because my values, this is what I think is really, and sure, the anywheres, somewheres fits into that model, but it's more, and you know, people get upset and use it because understandably, this was a theory that was developed by the New School of Social Research coming to America after the Second World War to explain the rise of fascism and the Holocaust. So obviously someone's going to get a bit off, put off if you say you're following a fascist pattern. But on
that topic, and let's build up this because this is an area you've spent a lot of time exploring, sort of the rise of authoritarian kind of thinking. And later in this podcast series, I'm going to interview Jonathan Whaler and Mark Hetherington. Right,
yeah, who
wrote that book, Pick Up a Prius, which looked at worldviews. And I know you've done a lot of work on the open versus closed. They use the term fluid versus fixed.
Yeah.
But your point about Brexit or Trump or, you know, that geography is not a very powerful driver. What matters more is who lives in those places, right? And you've done work looking at, maybe you can explain a little bit on the open and closed. We don't want to take all their thunder away, but I think you bring a really interesting perspective on Canada. And so, you know, I think sometimes we live, and I want to get into myths of Canadian public opinion in a minute, but we sometimes look down at the US, to your point earlier, and say, oh, we're so different. Trump could never happen here, right?
Yeah.
But I see evidence, and I've done some of the similar work that you've done. I see evidence not as a majoritarian view, that a majority of the country feels this way, but there's a sizable minority that whose personality aligns very closely to the closed, more fixed worldview that would have voted for Brexit, would vote for someone like Trump, or, you know, view the world as a dangerous place. How does that play into your way of understanding sort of the ebbs and flows of people's behavior and when it comes to politics and other things in the country?
Well, I think it's the most important and frankly disturbing force operating in advanced Western democracies right now. And whereas populism, the broader concept is ideologically thin, you can have populism on the left, the right, the center. Sometimes it works out well, as in the case of Roosevelt's. That was populist movement, produced the New Deal and the rise of shared prosperity. But authoritarian populism, and I know Mark, and I presented with him, and he's a great guy. I know you've used some of his index here in Canada, as have I. He also, I talk about order versus open. He talks about fixed fluid. We both are talking about authoritarianism, and we both know that we can't use that label. His publisher said, no, find something else. I actually like order because I think it comes, a lot closer to the basic idea. There's some debate whether it's actually a personality type or is it a worldview, a Weltanschauung, if you like, that's triggered under certain conditions. I actually think Theodore Adorno, who came up with the original formulation, although he worked with social psychologists and they did measure it, he was more of it was a worldview, which is actually more disturbing because it means that, you know, the sort of pathological effects of Trump are kind of incidental in a sense. They aren't going to just disappear because of his, you know, this personality distortion. But I have seen like tremendous evidence of sorting going on. And you're right, this force is smaller in Canada than it is in the United States. In fact, I think it's about 30%, could be as high as 20-25%, could be as low as 25%, could be as high as 35%. But it's incredibly emotionally engaged, and it's not, and I know in the States, Wheeler and Hetherington say the same thing, it's not the traditional conservative vote. It's some of those have morphed, but some of this is just sorting. So for example, the conservative vote in the, you know, in Reagan era, even after, was college educated, affluent, white, that part stayed, suburban, believe in minimal government, deregulation, global, trade liberalization. But that's got very little to do with this group you see today. They're kind of uncomfortably along for the ride. And the same dilemma is faced by guys like Mr. O'Toole in Canada, trying to figure out how do I keep, you know, the traditional status quo conservatives, which is the terms Karen Stenner uses. By the way, her work, she did a tremendous work on this and had a seminal piece in 2005, which influenced Hetherington and Wheeler and others. There's a lot of people working on this right now, but it's really, really a critical challenge. If I showed you just how different, even in Canada, the conservative vote from the last election was compared to, say, going back to 2015, but even more strikingly, 2011, on questions of just the incidence of people who are self-defined working class, educational attainment, beliefs about immigration and visible minority immigration, attitudes to science, really massive changes in a very short period of time. I had some of this published in the University of Calgary Policy Journal last spring, which was frankly a bit of a struggle because the reaction in Canada is often, oh, that's not happening here. And we kind of range between sneering and denial, which really doesn't help because it is a very powerful force and it does need to be understood.
And it's impacting, I think, sharply the decisions that Aaron O'Toole has to make, right? That if an increasing size of your base and your support is of this worldview, and you're those donating money, those volunteering, how do you pivot away from them without them, you know, the Max Bernier's of the world kind of broke away, but he didn't fundamentally take that group with him. And there's still lots within the party. Yeah. No, I think it's so important to our politics. It explains so much of the challenge that party has on issues like climate change, for example. Right.
Yeah. And what you have now are sort of two Canadas eyeing each other warily from two sides of the cliff with almost no common ground. Now, interestingly, there isn't much common ground, but one has emerged in the we're still in the pandemic. And that's a unity of view on the importance of restoring manufacturing in Canada.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to find anything we can agree on. I think we better build some bridges on those areas where we do have them. And I don't envy Mr. O'Toole his challenge here. If he were to kind of just say, I'm going to cut loose these people who have these really, views which are anti-science, they're so far off the consensus view on everything, you just go to get the Hillary Clinton reaction, you're just a basket of deplorables. You know, it doesn't really solve anything, it just makes them more angry because they're being driven by fear and anger. But if you took them out of his party, he'd be smaller than the NDP. So, I mean, he's got, now there's a chance, I think they could negotiate to try and find the center-right and hope that there's a pratfall from the Liberals' part, and then reoccupy that space. But the other alternative is do exactly what they've been doing now, which is trying to straddle those two different, the status quo Conservatives and the new ordered populists.
So on that note, just to wrap up then, thanks again for your time. So when we're recording this, we're just about to finish the year. 2020 is almost behind us. And even the Prime Minister over the last few days said a spring election is likely to happen, although he says he doesn't want one. What do you think then, you know, you talked about COVID and how rapidly it's changed people's behaviors in some areas, it's people's beliefs. Where do you think Canadians are, you know, at the end of 2020, as we look to 2021, and how does it affect, you know, the political landscape, the possible spring election? You know, what are you seeing?
Well, it's had tremendous political impacts and in contrary directions. I polled the United States during the last election and found, I asked that trust question and got the lowest ever score at 16%. In Canada, we got the highest score in 30 years. Which is an interesting, and I've seen data from Europe that shows the same thing. Canadians put an enormous amount of emphasis and trust in government to solve this. A lot of those fault lines we talked about temporarily diminished. They're reestablishing themselves now around issues like vaccine and masks and openings and so forth. And I think they, but I do believe that they just set the table for what will be a broader debate about what will be post-pandemic Canada and the post-pandemic world look like. And I believe that at the heart of it, there are these ordered and open models, and they both have a little wind in their sails because of this. On the open side, they go, hey, we really misunderstood the balancing of quality of life and health and climate sustainability. Mm-hmm. It's now clear that those are more important than just pursuing GDP and, you know, maximum wealth. And maybe we need to write some of these, the scores I'm seeing on social justice issues like you know, racial injustice, indigenous, restoring their rights, highest I've seen in 30 years. On the other hand, things like, well, I think we should keep those borders pretty closed. I'm not sure we want people coming from other countries right now. I think we really need to focus on building everything here because the fragility of global supply chains has been laid bare. You know, you can see two very distinct models emerging, both which I think could find a healthy constituency. I think we will see a spring election, mostly because it just seems like, and this is unfortunate, I really mean that, the parties just don't seem to like each other very much. And I just don't see the shelf life for a minority government persisting indefinitely under those circumstances. I think right now, I think your polling shows similar things. I think the Liberals are in better, much better shape than they were in February before this thing arrived. If they handle the vaccine rollout, and our evidence is that they seem to be handling it reasonably well, and then maybe the opposition are overshooting in terms of the continued attacks on, they may well be in a position to get a majority in the spring. Is that what we should be doing as we come up? I don't know. Probably not. But I think will it be likely? Yeah, I think the Conservatives will want to pull the switch, regardless of whether the chances are tremendous. And I think the Liberals will go, well, you know, so what? It wasn't our fault, and we'll take the majority. Thank you very much.
Interesting. Well, on that note, Frank, thank you very much for your time. Your point about the pandemic accelerating the divide between, as you describe them, the ordered and the open is really interesting, because I think you're right. You could look at this crisis from two different vantage points and come to completely different conclusions about what we should be doing. And it kind of feels that, like, if you think of the two major parties, they're kind of inching towards those two directions. And so the sorting might continue, and you know, Erin O'Toole doubling down on Canada First, anti-China, and Trudeau talking about transition to you know, zero emissions and building back better. That feels like that split continuing to happen. So thank you so much.
Thank you. So enjoyable to be here with you today, David. I'm glad we could do this.